We looked this morning at what I called the busiest week, and now tonight we have the longest night. And the longest night ran on into the darkest day, and the darkest day was followed by the brightest dawn. And they briefly are the four areas that I want to consider as we look at the closing stages of the life of our Lord, his sacrificial death, and then his glorious resurrection. We left off this morning with a few Greeks coming to Jerusalem. These were people who worshipped God. That is, they were non-Jewish people who had been attracted to the Jewish faith because of the purity of the Jews or the morality that the Jews practiced. And so they went along to the synagogue services. And they were called God-fearers or worshippers of God. They had come wanting to see Jesus. And when the disciples brought that news to Jesus, it reminded Jesus indeed that the hour of his triumph had come, but that triumph was going to involve much suffering. And so his soul was troubled, but he said, "Father, what shall I say? Save me from this hour? No, but for this cause came I to this hour." Those words are noble words when we think of them, but when we come now to Luke chapter 22, we find that it was going to involve a tremendous conflict as Jesus wrestled with this great problem of bearing man's sin. Remember that he'd been through several days of conflict with the Jewish leaders, and they'd been looking for a way to catch him. But they daren't arrest him because there was a lot of excitement in Jerusalem at the time, and the Jewish leaders weren't quite sure how many people were on the side of Jesus. It was festival time. There were Jews from all over Palestine there, and many of them from parts beyond Palestine. And as I say, there were even some non-Jewish people there, because this was Passover time. This was the great festival when people came from far and near to Jerusalem to the temple to celebrate it. Connected with the festival of Passover was, of course, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which went for 7 days. Put together, the Passover and the Unleavened Bread festival commemorated the time of Israel's great escape from Egypt back in the time of Moses. And in chapter 22 of Luke, the chief priests and the scribes in verse 2 were looking how they could catch Jesus and put him to death, but they feared the people. They still were frightened that if they arrested him publicly, there could be a riot. And they didn't want to have the whole of that festival season messed up with some major riot in the middle of Jerusalem. But right as they were trying to sort out how in fact they could get Jesus, but yet get him in such a way that they didn't create a riot, right in the middle of that, their problem was solved when Judas, one of Jesus' 12, came and offered to betray Jesus to them. He worked out a deal with them. It was an inside job, and an inside job, of course, solves a lot of problems. There was somebody on the inside who would betray him, and that solved all the problems then for the Jewish leaders. And so they worked it out then, how Judas could find a convenient time when he could hand Jesus over to them, and that's spoken of there in the next few verses. And he wanted to do it, we see at the end of verse 6, in the absence of the multitude. Now that was the whole purpose. The Jewish leaders and Judas worked out how they could get Jesus at a time when it was quiet and private and when the multitude of people wouldn't be a wake-up concerning what was going on. But there was one person who was a wake-up, and that one person was Jesus. The other disciples didn't know. The other apostles, they weren't aware of what was going on, but somehow Jesus knew what Judas was up to. And although Jesus knew he'd come to the hour when he was to give his life, he wasn't going to give his life before he had done all the things he wanted to do. He yet had much teaching he wanted to give his disciples. He wanted to have that final Passover feast with them. So he worked it in such a way that he would do the things he wanted to do before Judas had his chance to hand him over to the Jewish authorities. Jesus arranged with two people where he was going to have that evening meal. Now the apostles didn't know. None of the 12 apostles knew. But Jesus had met these other two men privately. We don't even know the names of these men. One of them owned a house, and the other man was a chap who was a friend of his. Jesus had a secret plan that he worked out so that they could prepare the Passover meal. Now the 12 were still together, and Judas was waiting to find out where Jesus was going to be so that he could go off and tell the Jewish authorities where they could find him and capture him. But Jesus knew what Judas was up to, so he didn't give Judas the chance. So when he was meeting with his 12, probably, I should imagine, it was on the afternoon of the Thursday, let us say sometime after lunch. Jesus was meeting with these 12, and he said, "I'm going to have a Passover meal with you fellows tonight. I've arranged it in a certain place. Now, Peter and John, I want you two chaps to go downtown And as you're walking along a certain street, you'll see a man carrying a water jar. Now, that was in itself a little uncommon, because men didn't normally do those domestic tasks, but Jesus had arranged that that would be the sign. Now, he says, you follow that man, and he'll take you to a house, and the owner of that house has prepared a room for us, and there we're going to have our Passover meal. Now, Jesus was the only person who knew where that house was. None of the 12 apostles knew. Now, John and Peter had to go off, of course, and follow this series of signs, and eventually get to the house. Now, that really stopped Judas from working any skullduggery. So Judas was sitting there, looking embarrassed, because he couldn't now go up and tell the fellows where Jesus would be, because he himself didn't know where Jesus was going to be. So he had to hang around with the other 10, or the other 9, for a little longer yet. So off they went then and prepared for the evening meal. In verse 14, we find that the hour has come, and they all sat down to have this Passover meal on the night before the actual Passover day. This was the Thursday night. I suppose it was something like 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening when Jesus sat down with his 12 apostles to have this Passover meal with them. Now, the Passover meal had many customs associated with it. They ate unleavened bread in memory of the time when they fled Egypt. In fleeing Egypt, they had no time to cook their bread in ovens and put yeast in and wait for it to rise. They had to cook it flat, unleavened, on open cooking pans as they walked along the street, getting out of Egypt in a hurry. So they ate their bread unleavened in commemoration of that event. They also had bitter herbs that went with it. They had various drinks, wine that went around the table. There were various circuits of things that were passed around the table as they followed the procedures through. There were various hymns that were sung. It was a well-planned and a customary type of celebration that the Jews had carried on year after year for centuries. Jesus followed through that with his disciples. And in the course of it, he took the wine on one occasion, and he took the bread on one occasion, and said, now these things, take them as symbols of me, because I'm about to give my life for you. But as you eat this bread and drink this wine in future, you can do so in memory of me and my sacrifice until I come. So I'm going to go away from you, he says, and one day in the future I'm going to return. But in the meantime, you partake of bread and wine in memory of me, but also in communion with me. So even though I'll be absent, this will be a communion with me during my absence. And then, when I return, bread and wine won't be needed any longer, because we'll then have true fellowship together in the kingdom. So he says, I'm not going to eat this bread or drink this cup with you again from here on until we do so afresh when the kingdom of God comes. Then he made known to them the fact that one of them was going to betray him. He says, woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. And in verse 23, they began to question among themselves who it was. Apparently, they didn't suspect anyone of treachery. I gather that when they questioned among themselves, they were thinking that probably one of them was going to make a blunder somewhere. Somebody was going to put his foot in it. Through accident or through saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, somebody was going to do something that would foul the whole thing up and would result in Jesus being arrested. And they said, I wonder who'll do this. I don't think that they suspected that one among them was actually a fifth columnist, that there was an actual traitor among them. I don't think that's what's meant when it says they questioned among themselves. I think they were really worried. Who's going to be foolish enough or careless enough to make such a blunder? And Jesus says the Son of Man must indeed go, as has been determined, but woe to that man by whom he is betrayed. No excuse for Judas, even though the death of Jesus was according to the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God. Judas knew what he was doing, and he is entirely responsible for it. And the remarkable thing is that all this came after Jesus himself had washed the disciples' feet. Before the meal started, he went around and washed all their feet and said, as I have done to you, so you should do to each other. He, their master, actually becoming their servant, saying to us, of course, that we must become servants of each other. And yet that was totally lost on Judas. Even that demonstration of humility in serving others, that was lost on Judas. He was out simply for his own gain. And the remarkable thing is that immediately after Jesus says that, we find in verse 24 that a dispute arises among them over who was to be the greatest. You'd hardly believe it, would you? That in the middle of Jesus telling them about his coming sacrifice, after he has just demonstrated that they must be prepared to be servants of each other, their memories are so short that they start to now talk about the coming kingdom and which among them would have the top slots in the coming administration. Who's going to be greatest among them? We are frightfully insensitive at times, aren't we? And the lessons that we learn are so often lost on us. How often is it that we've met and worshipped and we remember the great sacrifice that Jesus has made for us, and we've praised the Lord with lofty songs, and we poured out our hearts in thanks to him, and within a matter of hours We're back to the old selfishness again. We're competing with others and we're trying to get on top of the stack and beat somebody else to the goal that we're after. You know the sort of horrible selfishness that's part of our human makeup? Well, here it is demonstrated. You'd hardly believe that on the very occasion when Jesus is talking about his sacrifice for them, they very soon get digressed into arguing who's going to be the chief among them when the coming kingdom bursts upon the scene. Well, when Jesus tells them that there's going to be someone there who'll betray him, Peter, with typical boldness, says, "Not me." He says, "One of the others might," but he says, "I'm sure I won't. Even to denying you," he says, "I wouldn't deny you." And Jesus said, "I'm afraid that some of you are going to deny me, that when the crunch comes, you'll find that you look after your own skin rather than stand firm for me." "Not me," says Peter. "Others might, but not me." And Jesus says in verse 31, he says, "Peter, Satan demands to have you, that he might sift you like wheat. I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail." Now, it did falter for a while, but it didn't fail, absolutely. "But when you have turned again, you can then strengthen your brethren." Peter was going to learn something out of this lesson, and it's going to emerge as we move on through the story in one of our subsequent studies, how that Peter did indeed learn, and this experience did indeed change him. But at the time, he was utterly confident. He said, "Lord, I am ready to go with you to prison and even to death." Well, there's nothing wrong with his confidence, is there? Well, as we all know, Peter wasn't quite as clever as he had thought he was. During that time there in the upper room, there was a lot of teaching given. It's at this time that John chapters 14, 15, 16, 17 probably take place. Now, some of the teaching given in those chapters may in fact have taken place earlier, and it may simply have been put in the record at that particular point in the story for various reasons. But I do think there's a fairly good indication that much of that teaching was given by Jesus on that night, because it is to do with the fact that he was about to go, but even though he was about to go and leave them in death, he had made provision for their futures in the provision of the Holy Spirit. And all that teaching that goes through John chapters 14 to 17 probably was given in some form, to greater or lesser degree, that night. And so it was a long night after the supper, which would have taken a couple of hours to eat, and then Jesus washing the feet prior to the supper, and then giving this teaching after the supper, and the exit of Judas, and all the other teaching. It was probably well after midnight by the time they had left the room and headed off in verse 39 to the Mount of Olives. It was their custom to go and have prayer there on the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives was a hill on the other side of the little brook that ran down the side of Jerusalem. They went up there, and I'm sure that the disciples thought it was probably going to be more or less much as it had been previously when they'd gone up there for a time of prayer and communion together. But this occasion was one that was something they had never experienced before. Perhaps it was a combination of the great satanic forces that were at work there, the great wrestling of spiritual powers that contributed to their drowsiness. Maybe they were just plain tired anyway. But we notice that they all nodded off to sleep. Jesus was up there praying in that Garden of Gethsemane for an hour. And he was only human after all. And I shouldn't say he was only human, but he was human as well as being God. It was a great heresy of the church, of course, that some people deny the deity of Jesus Christ. They deny that he was God. But there are also other heresies that deny that he was man. And in the early church you find that both heresies were rampant. And although we are very jealous to say that Jesus was indeed God and we reject those who would deny his deity, let us not make the opposite mistake of denying his humanity. Some people at times speak of Jesus in such a way that you get the impression that they don't think he was really quite man, that he was only an extra special angel pretending to be man. But he was man. He was entirely man just as much as he was entirely God. And he had the human feelings that we're all familiar with. Except, of course, the sinful attitudes that characterize us. But the feelings of loneliness, the feelings of hunger, the feelings of the need for sympathy in a crisis, wrestling with temptation, all these things Jesus experienced. This was the time when he was really wrestling with this issue before him the next day. He knew that he had to die to bear man's sin. And he took three of his disciples with him and moved off just a little separate from the other group of disciples. And these three, he asked them just to stay there with him while he prayed. Now, they couldn't do anything really to help him. But you see the human nature of Jesus there, as he just desired this sympathy, this understanding, so that they could just be there a few paces away from him while he wrestled through. He knew that the sin which he had to bear was a difficulty that he had to face alone. It was a battle he had to fight and win by himself. But he would have been comforted if those three fellows had just stayed awake there and more or less prayed along with him. But we all know, of course, that they went to sleep. But Jesus didn't go to sleep. He fought with his problem, and he says, Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. This cup, this bitter cup I must drink, figuratively speaking, of course, this death that I must die. Not just the physical suffering, that was bad enough, but the suffering of this holy, sinless person who hated sin more than you and I can ever possibly realize, the fact that he had to bear our sin. He who knew no sin had to be made sin for us. And there his holy person was to take upon itself all the rottenness of human nature and all the sin and the judgment, God's judgment upon sin. And he said, if only there was some other way of dealing with it. Remove this cup from me, if possible. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And as he wrestled with his problem, his sweat became like great drops of blood which fell down to the ground. So great was the battle that was going on there. But he won that battle. And then he rose, and in the strength of that battle, he was able to go forth. He'd wrestled with this temptation to turn back, to look for another way. But he realized there was no other way. And having come through that battle in the Garden of Gethsemane, triumphant, he then went on, and in the strength of that, he faced all that lay ahead. And as you read the story of Jesus from there on, you find that no longer is this wrestling. What shall I say, Father, save me from this hour? We saw that the day before, didn't we, on the Thursday? No, but for this cause came I to this hour. And now again, Father, can you remove this cup from me? Nevertheless, not what I want, but I'll do what you want me to do. And as he fought that problem, and he won it, he won the victory, and he went forth, and in the strength of that, he faced all that lay ahead. And we don't find again any record of that wrestling. The confidence which characterized him from there on is quite outstanding. It's quite monumental, really, in the whole story of Jesus. He came back to his disciples, of course, and they were asleep. And he says, why did you sleep? Rise and pray that you may not enter into temptation. He said there's a testing time ahead, and you have to have particular strength from God if you're really to stand through it. Now, while they'd all been asleep, Judas had had just the opportunity he'd been looking for. They all slept while Jesus was there, and he was praying for an hour. Now, Judas had been able, we know that he'd gone and contacted these leaders previously, but he'd now been able to manipulate the whole procedure. They're sitting ducks, you might say. By the time they wake up, it's all finished, more or less. Judas has already arrived. He's been down there, and he's got these men together. He's got these leaders, he's got the Jewish leaders, he's got a few Roman guards, he's got some temple guards, he's got a few temple officials, and this motley crew with sticks and staves and a few weapons, they've come to arrest Jesus. I guess it's about 1 o'clock in the morning by now. 1:30 perhaps, 2 o'clock maybe. And Peter suddenly gets his second wind. He comes to life, and so do all the other apostles who've been rather sleepy-headed. And Peter now is going to put into practice his bravery expressed earlier in the evening. And in verse 49 he says, Lord, shall we strike these fat fellows with a sword? He'd previously said he was going to fight on to the death, and he showed now that he was prepared to. He says, yes, he says, I'll go even to prison and to death for you. And now he's going to demonstrate it. Peter was playing for keeps. He started swinging his sword pretty wildly, and a few of the fellows that came to arrest them started to duck and weave and get out of the road, and one chap wasn't quite successful in getting out of the road entirely, and he lost an ear. As Peter was, he was really ready to take their heads off. And Jesus said to Peter, look, Peter, put your sword away. Those who take the sword will ultimately perish by the sword. The anger and the wrath of men is not going to bring God's purposes about. And Peter had to learn that. Jesus said, the hour has come, I must go. Once again he wanted his disciples to go with him. And so off they went, and this crowd led him off in verse 54 to the high priest's house. We find that the rest of the disciples scattered. They didn't have much of a stomach for the battle, except for Peter and John. At least they stuck with him that far. They kept their distance, of course, they were looking after their own skin, but at least they followed him as far as the high priest's house. The high priest was a man called Caiaphas. The previous high priest was a chap called Annas, and Annas happened to be Caiaphas' father-in-law. They lived in the same house. Jesus was brought, first of all, to Annas. Annas questioned him and tried to find out what was going on to get an accusation that they could lay against him. But he wasn't successful. In the meantime, Peter and John were outside. And of course we know the story how someone came along to Peter and they said, you are one of his people. Peter 3 times, of course, denied it. But then, as Jesus had warned earlier, he says, Peter, before the cock crows, you will deny me 3 times. And after the third denial, Peter heard the cock crow, and of course he just broke down and wept. And he had denied his Lord in spite of all the great professions of bravado and confidence that he had. When the crunch came, he who was prepared to lay down his life, wasn't even prepared to stand up and say that he was a friend of Jesus. A lot of us are very brave, aren't we, in singing songs about how we're going to sacrifice for the Lord, but sometimes we can't even make the stand in the simplest of situations. And the cock crowed, which means it must have been about 4:30 or 5:00 in the morning by now. Jesus had also been taken to Caiaphas, and Caiaphas also had cross-questioned Jesus in an attempt to get some statement from him which they could use as an accusation. He hadn't been entirely successful, but they had to wait until day broke, because the Sanhedrin is the Jewish council, of which the high priest was the president. The Sanhedrin was the Jewish authority, the Jewish council, which brought judgment upon cases that were up for consideration. It was illegal for the Jewish council to meet at night to judge a capital offence or a capital charge. And if you've lived in a society where there is no electricity, you can understand why. Because all sorts of things can happen in the dark where there's only dim light coming from candles and lamps. All sorts of shady things happen. And it was a Jewish law that judgment in capital cases could only be carried out in daylight. It was illegal for a council to sit in judgment on such an offence or such an allegation at night. But they sat nevertheless. They had rounded up the members of the Sanhedrin, and most of them by this time had arrived at Caiaphas's house. But it wasn't yet daybreak, and so they couldn't really lay a formal charge, even though they managed to harass Jesus for several hours. And when they weren't harassing him with their questions, we find in verse 63 that some of the others there were mocking him, beating him, punching him, and some of them even blindfolded him to get a few bits of sport out of him and said, "Here, prophesy, tell us, if you're so clever, who struck you?" As cheap as you can imagine the entertainment they're getting for themselves as they blindfold Jesus and then take it in turns of poking him and seeing if he can guess who it was that hit him. Jesus, of course, didn't cooperate with their little game. He just silently put up with it all. But they managed to while away the time until day broke. And then in verse 66, we find that day at last came. And now, of course, a meeting of the Sanhedrin is legal because the sun is up. It's probably now about 5:30, 5:45 or something like that. And so in verse 66, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led Jesus away to their council, which was now meeting officially and legally. And now they wanted to get this statement from Jesus. And they said, "If you are the Christ, the Messiah, now tell us." He said to them, oh, this is a magnificent reply. He said to them, "If I tell you, you do not believe. And if I ask you, you do not answer. What's the point?" Isn't that what we saw this morning? When he told them and presented the facts, they wouldn't believe. When he threw the questions back at them and asked them to answer his questions, they wouldn't answer. He says, "You're just wanting me to say two or three words." But he says, "What's the point of speaking to people like you? If I tell you, you don't believe that I'm telling the truth. And when I ask you questions, you don't answer me. So what's the point of holding any dialogue with people who are as irresponsible as you are?" However, he knew that his hour had come. And for the one time in Jesus' life, he now plainly says, "Yes, I am the Messiah." But he says more than that. He goes on to say, "From now on, you'll see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power on high," the power of God. And they said to him, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said, "You say that I am." And they said, "What further testimony do we need? We've heard it from his own lips. Blasphemy." Jesus referred to himself as the heavenly Son of Man. That was another prophecy given in the Old Testament, in Daniel chapter 7. This heavenly Son of Man was a figure who went to the Ancient of Days and received from him an eternal and everlasting kingdom. He was a divine figure. They also had the Old Testament figure of the Messiah. They also had the Old Testament figure of the suffering servant. And Jesus says, in effect, "I am all three. I am the heavenly Son of Man, I am the Davidic Messiah, I am the suffering servant, I am on my way to crucifixion and via crucifixion to my glory. And henceforth, you're going to see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of glory." If you read the account in Mark, there, Jesus says it in straight out terms. When Caiaphas says to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Jesus says, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." Whereupon the high priest tore his mantle. "What do we need as further witness? We have heard this blasphemy. What is your decision?" And they said, "He deserves death." That was the penalty for blasphemy. Well, now they decide they'll march him off to Pilate, because Pilate is the one who can carry out the death sentence. The Jews could pass the death sentence, their council could pass the sentence, but they couldn't carry it out. Only Pilate, the Roman governor, had the authority and the power to carry out the death sentence. But it wouldn't be much point going off to see Pilate and telling him that Jesus was guilty of blasphemy. not very impressive for a civilian governor to talk about a religious offence. And so they manipulate the offence. They manipulate the charge. And you come into the next couple of verses in chapter 23. For example, in verse 2, when they actually brought him to Pilate, they said, "We found this man perverting our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar and saying that he himself is a king." Now, that was a complete twist of the judgment that they had handed down. They had condemned Jesus to death on the charge of blasphemy, but there's not a mention of that when they go to Pilate. They twist it to give it a political flavour and say that he's a rebel, he forbids people paying tribute to Caesar, he calls himself a king, setting himself up in opposition to the emperor. That was the charge they carried through with Pilate. But by now, of course, it's morning. And if you read the account in Mark, you find, in fact, that the time when they took Jesus to Pilate was 6 o'clock in the morning. Just spare a thought for Jesus. All through Thursday, then Thursday afternoon, and then organizing the Passover, then the Passover at night, the meal, the teaching, the washing of the disciples' feet, the exit of Judas, the betrayal, off to the garden, the agony in the garden, an hour or so there, the arrest, all the manhandling, all the confrontation, back to the high priest's house, buffeting and manhandling and all the rest of it. And now through to the morning, now he's taken off to Pilate and the charge is read. The longest night is over, but the darkest day is about to begin.